1950. His supporters received a thrashing at the polls. Despite the setback, he continued to discuss plans to militarily unify Korea under his own command in the coming months. Kim, too, spoke of reunification, but under communist control. Ri's electoral setback and overall unpopularity gave Kim the opening he was looking for. In spring 1950, Stalin, after repeated entreaties from the North Korean leader, gave Kim the green light to invade the South. Believing that a South Korean attack on the North was coming, Stalin decided to act first. He was feeling a new burst of confidence. He now had the atomic bomb and had just concluded a formal alliance with Mao. Kim promised a swift victory. Truman was in Missouri when word of the North Korean invasion reached him. Immediately concluding that the attack represented a new stage of communist aggression, he decided that the United States must respond militarily. The New York Times urged Truman to act decisively or risk losing half a world. Acting decisively would also silence the Republicans, who blamed Truman for losing China. He quickly pushed a resolution through the UN Security Council, which the Soviets had been boycotting over its refusal to cede communist China. Despite deploying tens of thousands of troops, Truman refused to call the intervention a war, instead latching on to the terminology of a reporter who asked if it would be possible to call this a police action under the United Nations. Although it was nominally a UN effort, the United States provided half the ground forces and almost all of the naval and air power. Most of the other ground forces came from South Korea. Truman also opted to bypass congressional authorization, setting the precedent for future wars. In a memo he wrote a month before the attack, John Foster Dulles pessimistically surveyed the declining U.S. strategic position. "The situation in Japan may become untenable," he wrote, "and possibly that in the Philippines. Indonesia, with its vast natural resources, may be lost, and the oil of the Middle East will be in jeopardy. None of these places provide holding grounds once the people feel that communism is the wave of the future." But he offered a glimmer of hope. "This series of disasters can probably be prevented if at some doubtful point we quickly take a dramatic and strong stand that shows our confidence and resolution. Probably this series of disasters cannot be prevented any other way." The United States would take that stand in Korea. Truman told congressional leaders, "If we let Korea down, the Soviet will keep right on going and swallow up one piece of Asia after another. We had to make a stand sometime, or else let all of Asia go by the board. If we were to let Asia go, the Near East would collapse and no telling what would happen in Europe. Therefore, I have ordered our forces to support Korea, and it is equally necessary for us to draw the line at Indochina, the Philippines, and Formosa." Truman particularly feared a Soviet incursion into Iran. On June 26th, he called Korea the Greece of the Far East. Spinning a globe and pointing to Iran, he told staffers, "Here is where they will start trouble if we aren't careful. If we are tough enough now, if we stand up to them like we did in Greece 3 years ago, they won't take any next steps. But if we just stand by, they'll move into Iran and they'll take over the whole Middle East." The communist victory in China had raised the stakes in Korea. Having lost the China market, Japan now looked to Korea and Southeast Asia, where conditions were also volatile. In Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh's communist-led forces were challenging French rule. A powerful insurgent movement was competing for power in the Philippines. British colonial interests were under attack in Malaya. Acheson explained, "It became apparent in Washington that the U.S. had to adopt a very firm stance in the Far East, especially since the governments of many Western European nations appeared to be in a state of near panic as they watched to see whether the United States would act or not." More than 100,000 Soviet-trained and equipped North Korean troops overwhelmed U.S. and South Korean forces, pinning them down around Pusan. MacArthur had turned a blind eye toward CIA warnings and other evidence that the attack was coming. Facing defeat, MacArthur requested and received permission to push past the 38th parallel and liberate the North, He staged a surprise amphibious landing of 17,000 men at Incheon in September. Truman lauded MacArthur's brilliant maneuver and described his Korean campaign as being rivaled by few operations in military history. Truman bent over backward to placate the prickly MacArthur. Republicans seized on any hint that Truman might hesitate to send U.S. troops across the border as a sign of appeasement. MacArthur assured Truman that the Chinese would not enter the fight, but agreed to use only Korean troops as he moved toward the Chinese border. Acheson had also dismissed the possibility of Chinese involvement as sheer madness. MacArthur even spoke about the fighting ending by Thanksgiving and having the troops out by Christmas. He dismissed repeated warnings by Chinese Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai that the Chinese would enter the war if the United States persisted in its advance northward. The Chinese were also incensed over the U.S.-led campaign to deny them U.N. representation and the United States' decision to defend Formosa with the Seventh Fleet. Mao wanted to send troops, but the Chinese Politburo remained divided. Stalin sent encouragement. He assured Mao that the Soviets and Chinese were stronger than the United States, Great Britain, and their European allies, especially now, before Germany and Japan had been rearmed. Stalin had earlier told Kim that launching the war was a way to get back at the dishonest, perfidious, and arrogant behavior of the United States in Europe, the Balkans, the Middle East, and especially its decision to form NATO. MacArthur blithely disregarded his agreement to use only Korean troops and ordered the Air Force to bomb near the Chinese border. When the Joint Chiefs demanded that he not bomb within 5 miles of the border, he responded, "I cannot overemphasize the disastrous effect, both physical and psychological, that will result from the restrictions which you are imposing." Chinese forces attacked UN troops at Unsan on October 25th. On November 8th, the Joint Chiefs cabled MacArthur to suggest that his mission might need to be reconsidered. MacArthur replied that the pressure from British, French, and many Americans to stop at the 38th parallel found its historic precedence in the action taken at Munich. "To give up any part of North Korea to the aggression of the Chinese communists," he blustered, "would be the greatest defeat of the free world in recent times." Truman and the Joint Chiefs acceded to MacArthur's demands. On November 24th, MacArthur launched the major offensive that he believed would end the war. But suddenly, hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops streamed across the Yalu River, sending U.S. and Allied troops into a frantic retreat. The setback was devastating. MacArthur solemnly announced that "we face an entirely new war." Acheson told Congress that the United States was on the brink of World War III. Truman agreed. "It looks like World War III is here," he wrote in his diary. General Omar Bradley called it the greatest military disaster in the history of the United States. Time reported that it was the worst defeat the U.S. had ever suffered. China's UN Security Council spokesman heralded the resurgence of liberation movements throughout the region. "Regardless of the savagery and cruelty of the American imperialist aggressors, the hard-struggling people of Japan, the victoriously advancing people of Vietnam, the heroically resisting people of Korea, the people of the Philippines who have never laid down their arms, and all the oppressed nations and peoples of the East will certainly unite in close solidarity. They will fight dauntlessly on to win the final victory in their struggle for national independence." The British government favored ending the war as quickly as possible, believing, according to the Chicago Tribune, that it was being conducted in near hysteria and with prodigal waste. But U.S. leaders decided to first lay waste to North Korea. At the start of the war, MacArthur and others had advocated using atomic bombs in support of combat operations. "I see here a unique use for the atomic bomb. To strike a blocking blow, which would require a 6 months repair job. Sweeten up my B-29 force," he enthused. General Charles Bolt figured that 10 to 20 atomic bombs from the U.S. arsenal could be spared. In July, Truman sent nuclear-configured bombers to Great Britain and Guam. The Joint Chiefs decided, however, that given the small size of most Korean cities, conventional bombing would suffice. They also expressed concern about Soviet retaliation and public revulsion at such acts. But now, following the entry of the Chinese into the conflict, the United States was desperate, and the Chinese offered more suitable targets. Truman stunned the press corps in late November 1950 by announcing that all options, explicitly including atomic devastation, were on the table. If aggression is successful in Korea, we can expect it to spread throughout Asia and Europe to this hemisphere. We are fighting in Korea for our own national security and survival. Question: will that include the atomic bomb? The President: that includes every weapon that we have. Question: does that mean that there is active consideration of the use of the atomic bomb? The President: there has always been active consideration of its use. Question: does that mean, Mr. President, use against military objectives or civilian? The President: it's a matter that the military people will have to decide. The military commander in the field will have charge of the use of the weapons, as he always has. That day, Air Force General George Stratemeyer ordered SAC Commander General Hoyt Vandenberg to dispatch atomic-capable bomb groups to the Far East. LeMay volunteered to direct the attacks. Representative Mendel Rivers of South Carolina declared, "If there ever was a time to use the A-bomb, it is now." Senator Owen Brewster from Maine proposed using it against the Chinese. Representative Tom Steed of Oklahoma preferred the Kremlin. Representative Joseph Bryson of South Carolina just wanted to make sure it was dropped on somebody. The hour is at hand when every known force, including the atomic bomb, should be promptly utilized. Lloyd Benson of Texas, the future Democratic vice presidential candidate, proposed that the president advise the commander of the North Korean troops to withdraw beyond the 38th parallel within 1 week, or use that week to evacuate civilians from a specified list of North Korean cities that will be subjected to atomic attack by the United States Air Force. Gallup found that, by 52% to 38%, the public supported using atomic bombs, reversing earlier poll results. UN delegates warned that the Asian people would be horrified by such use. Attlee rushed across the Atlantic to tell Truman that the Europeans shared that horror. Following Attlee's visit, Truman told a group of congressmen that it would be wrong to hit Moscow's surrogates when the Kremlin was the real culprit, but that using atomic bombs against the Soviet Union would provoke retaliation against London, Berlin, and Paris. On December 9, 1950, MacArthur requested authorization to use atomic bombs at his discretion. On December 24th, he submitted a list of 26 targets. He also requested 4 bombs to drop on invading forces, and 4 more for critical concentrations of enemy air power. He calculated that dropping 30 to 50 atomic bombs across the neck of Manchuria could produce a belt of radioactive cobalt that would win the war in 10 days. But that was just the short-term effect. The belt of radioactive cobalt would spread from the Sea of Japan to the Yellow Sea. Therefore, he figured, for at least 60 years, there could have been no land invasion of Korea from the north. While MacArthur was conjuring up visions of atomic Armageddon, others were bemoaning the tremendous setback to the United States' international prestige caused by the debacle in Korea. New York Times correspondents in capitals across Europe, Asia, and the Middle East reported on the loss of confidence in the United States. In France, the decline in American prestige has been little short of disastrous. In India, where U.S. prestige has suffered immensely, many people were secretly pleased to see the Westerners trounced by Asians. Some questioned U.S. ability to halt a Soviet occupation of Europe, given how poorly U.S. forces had performed against China. With U.S. and South Korean casualties mounting rapidly, MacArthur began issuing statements from Tokyo blaming others for the military debacle and pushing for all-out war with China. On March 10, 1951, MacArthur requested a D-Day atomic capability in response to the Soviet bolstering of air capabilities in Korea and Manchuria and a buildup of Chinese forces near the Korean border. Finletter and Lovett alerted on atomic discussions, believe everything is set, Vandenberg wrote on March 14th. On March 24th, 1951, knowing that Truman was pressing for a ceasefire, MacArthur broadcast his own ultimatum to China. Truman bristled. I'll show that son of a bitch who's boss, but let the incident slide. But when Republican Congressman Joe Martin read to the entire House a letter that MacArthur had written, in which he stated that, if we lose this war to communism in Asia, the fall of Europe is inevitable, the Joint Chiefs unanimously recommended that MacArthur be relieved of his command. On April 11th, the White House announced MacArthur's firing. MacArthur's eagerness to use atomic weapons did not factor into this decision. Just the week before, the chiefs had ordered atomic attacks on Manchurian bases if the Chinese sent in another large contingent of forces. On April 6th, Truman approved that order and authorized the transfer of 9 atomic weapons from AEC to military custody on Guam and Okinawa. Firing MacArthur proved calamitous for Truman, whose approval rating sank below 30%. Seldom has a more unpopular man fired a more popular one, Time magazine noted. Republican leaders in the House and Senate met to discuss impeachment. Senator William Jenner accused the administration of treason. This country today is in the hands of a secret inner coterie, which is directed by agents of the Soviet Union. Our only choice is to impeach President Truman. Joseph McCarthy also wanted to impeach the son of a bitch for firing MacArthur and said that Truman must have been drunk at the time on bourbon and Benedictine. He accused Truman of signing the death warrant of Western civilization. The public sided with MacArthur. 7.5 million spectators cheered him at a New York parade. He received a hero's welcome in Washington, Boston, San Francisco, and Chicago. MacArthur emotionally defended his conduct of the war before a joint session of Congress and bade a final farewell. It has been said that I was a warmonger. Nothing could be further from the truth. I know war as few other men now living know it, and nothing to me is more revolting. I have long advocated its complete abolition, as its very destructiveness on both friend and foe has rendered it useless as a means of settling international disputes. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath at West Point, but I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye. The address was broadcast live on national radio. We saw a great hunk of God in the flesh, and we heard the voice of God, gushed Congressman Dewey Short of Missouri. Truman, however, chided the damn fool congressman crying like a bunch of women over nothing but a bunch of bullshit. MacArthur's reference to the ballad Old Soldiers Never Die touched off a popular music frenzy. An executive at Remick Music Corporation, which owned the copyright, described the reaction as an earthquake and ordered publication of 50,000 copies of the sheet music. Gene Autry rushed off his movie set to record a version for Columbia Records, which sold 25,000 copies a day. Decca Records quickly issued 2 versions, one by Red Foley, the other by Herb Jeffries. RCA Victor issued a version sung by Vaughn Monroe. Capitol Records put one out by Jimmy Wakely. Bing Crosby sang it live on his radio show. Columbia and RCA Victor recordings of MacArthur's speech were selling as fast as they could be stocked. Congressional hearings on MacArthur's firing and Asia policy went on for 2 months. Congressional Democrats and top military brass effectively rebutted MacArthur's arguments. General Bradley rejected MacArthur's proposed war with China as the wrong war, at the wrong place, at the wrong time, and with the wrong enemy. After that, MacArthur's luster faded rapidly. Truman's popularity never recovered. His approval rating sank to a record low of 22%. Acheson said that the war was an incalculable defeat to U.S. foreign policy and destroyed the Truman administration. MacArthur was replaced by General Matthew Ridgway, who requested 38 atomic bombs in May 1951. But that spring and summer, with Stalin's help, the United States, China, and the two Koreas began negotiations, which dragged on for 2 years. The U.S. air war continued unabated, unleashing a firebombing campaign similar to the one the United States had visited upon Japan 5 years earlier. Now the weapon of choice was napalm. New York Times reporter George Barrett described the effect of a napalm attack on a hamlet of 200 people north of Anyang, which he characterized as a macabre tribute to the totality of modern war. The inhabitants throughout the village and in the fields were caught and killed and kept the exact postures they had held when the napalm struck. A man about to get on his bicycle, 50 boys and girls playing in an orphanage, a housewife strangely unmarked, holding in her hand a page torn from a Sears Roebuck catalog, crayoned at mail order number 3,811,294 for a $2.98 bewitching bed jacket, coral. Almost every major city in North Korea was burned to the ground. Survivors sought shelter in caves. South Koreans fared little better. The British Armed Forces yearbook reported for 1951, "The war was fought without regard for the South Koreans, and their unfortunate country was regarded as an arena rather than a country to be liberated. As a consequence, fighting was quite ruthless, and it is no exaggeration to state that South Korea no longer exists as a country. Its towns have been destroyed, much of its means of livelihood eradicated, and its people reduced to a sullen mass dependent upon charity." The South Korean, unfortunately, was regarded as a gook, like his cousins north of the 38th parallel. Casualty estimates vary widely, but approximately 3 to 4 million Koreans died, out of a total population of 30 million, as did more than 1 million Chinese and 37,000 Americans. By February 1951, only 39% of Americans still supported the war. It ended in a stalemate. Americans wondered how their powerful modern military could fail to defeat an ill-equipped army of Korean and Chinese peasants. LeMay objected to the restraints placed upon the military, recalling that when the war started, "we slipped a note kind of under the door into the Pentagon and said, 'Look, let us go up there and burn down 5 of the biggest towns in North Korea. And they're not very big, and that ought to stop it.' Well, the answer to that was 4 or 5 screams. 'You'll kill a lot of non-combatants, and it's too horrible.' Yet over a period of 3 years or so, we burned down every town in North Korea, and South Korea too. Now, over a period of 3 years, this is palatable. But to kill a few people to stop this from happening, a lot of people can't stomach it." Korea was only one piece of a rapidly unraveling situation in Asia. In Indochina, the United States had decided to bolster its support for the French, making $10 million available for the French puppet Emperor Bao Dai in Vietnam. Trouble was also brewing in the Philippines, where the U.S.-backed president Manuel Roxas and his successor Elpidio Quirino had been battling the Hook peasant insurgency. After collaborating with the Japanese during the war, Roxas aligned himself with the large landowners and the Catholic Church. The United States built up the Philippine army and began a successful counterinsurgency campaign, spearheaded by Major Edward Lansdale and fortified by U.S. air power. A flamboyant advertising executive who served in the OSS and CIA and was immortalized in two famous novels, Lansdale would later lead similar counterinsurgency operations in Vietnam and Cuba, but with decidedly less success. And even in the Philippines, primary credit for undercutting the hooks should go not to Lansdale, but to President Ramon Magsaysay, who instituted land reform and welcomed the hooks back into the political system. The Korean War paved the way for the dramatic remilitarization of U.S. society. Truman approved NSC 68, and the defense budget for fiscal 1951 almost quadrupled, from $13.5 billion to $48.2 billion. Within 6 months of the start of the war, U.S. defense spending soared to $54 billion, providing a tremendous boost to the aerospace and defense sector across the country, and particularly in California. In Los Angeles County, 160,000 people worked in aircraft production, and 55% of county residents worked in the defense and aerospace sectors. In San Diego, the defense sector accounted for nearly 80% of all manufacturing. NATO was transformed into a full-fledged military structure, with a U.S. Supreme Commander and U.S. troops stationed in Europe. U.S. decisions to rearm Germany and sign a peace treaty with Japan, regardless of Soviet participation, further hardened the enmity between the United States and the USSR, leading the newly appointed U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, George Kennan, to worry that we had contributed by the over-militarization of our policies and statements to a belief in Moscow that it was war we were after. Given the hyper-militarization of American life, it was only fitting that one of the nation's top military men run for president. The 1952 election pitted Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson against General Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower chose anti-communist hatchet man, California Senator Richard Nixon, as his running mate. During the campaign, Nixon did Ike's dirty work, denouncing Adlai the appeaser, who carries a Ph.D. from Dean Acheson's cowardly College of Communist Containment. Senator Joseph McCarthy struck a similar theme, referring to the Democratic candidate as Alger, a reference to Alger Hiss. McCarthy had a particular vendetta against General George Marshall, whom he blamed for losing China during his tenure as Truman's Secretary of State. Eisenhower was set to defend his friend and mentor against such scurrilous attacks while campaigning in McCarthy's home state of Wisconsin. But Eisenhower backed off from a confrontation with the anti-communist demagogue, pusillanimously dropping a passage defending Marshall from his speech. He was apparently aware of the fact that an astounding 185 of the 221 Republican members of the House had requested appointment to the House Un-American Activities Committee. The Eisenhower campaign, which had inveighed against Democratic corruption, reached its nadir in September, when it was rocked by the news that conservative businessmen had given Nixon a secret donation of $18,000. Eisenhower's advisors echoed the public in demanding Nixon's ouster. In a last-ditch effort to rescue his candidacy, Nixon delivered his famous Checkers speech to 55 million television viewers. That bit of sentimentality saved the day for Nixon. But Eisenhower let Nixon twist in the wind a bit longer. He told Nixon to meet him in West Virginia. Nixon composed a letter of resignation and barked at an aide, "What more does he want? I'm not going to crawl on my hands and knees to him." The next day, Eisenhower met him at the airport and said, "Dick, you're my boy." Nixon broke down and cried. Eisenhower won the election handily, carrying 39 states. U.S.-Soviet relations were extremely tense when he took office in January 1953. Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles, his new Secretary of State, had done little to lower the temperature during the campaign, fanning the flames of anti-Sovietism with their calls to move beyond Democratic containment to Republican liberation. But Eisenhower had not always been such a perfervid anti-communist. He had pushed hard for opening a second front in 1942, and later developed a friendly relationship with Soviet Marshal Georgi Zhukov. After the war, he remained confident that U.S.-Soviet friendship would endure. Stalin, who held him in high regard, told U.S. Ambassador Averell Harriman, "General Eisenhower is a very great man, not only because of his military accomplishments, but because of his human, friendly, kind, and frank nature." Eisenhower visited Moscow in August 1945 and received a hero's welcome from the Soviet people. Stalin accorded him the special honor of being the first foreigner to witness a parade in Red Square from the platform atop Lenin's tomb. Later, in his farewell report as Army Chief of Staff, he rejected the facile equation of military strength and national security. "National security does not mean militarism or any approach to it. Security cannot be measured by the size of munitions stockpiles, or the number of men under arms, or the monopoly of an invincible weapon. That was the German and Japanese idea of power, which, in the test of war, was proved false. Even in time of peace, the index of material strength is unreliable, for arms become obsolete and worthless. Vast armies decay while sapping the strength of the nations supporting them. Monopoly of a weapon is soon broken." During his time in office, Eisenhower would be confronted with repeated opportunities to roll back the Cold War and arms race. Presiding over the world's most powerful nation during perhaps the tensest extended period in history, he could have taken bold action that would have put the world on a different path. Signs emanating from Moscow indicated that the Kremlin might be ready to change course. But because of ideology, political calculations, the exigencies of a militarized state, and limited imagination, he repeatedly failed to seize the opportunities that emerged. And although he deserves credit for avoiding war with the Soviet Union at a time when such a war seemed quite possible, he left the world a far more dangerous place than when he first took office. Eisenhower didn't have to wait long for an extraordinary opportunity to reverse the course of the Cold War. On March 5th, 1953, barely a month into Eisenhower's presidency, Joseph Stalin died. Some of Eisenhower's close advisors urged him to take advantage of the chaotic situation in Moscow and scare the daylights out of the enemy. The National Security Council, NSC, called for psychological exploitation of this event, and C.D. Jackson, Eisenhower's advisor on psychological warfare, proposed a general political warfare offensive. But the new Soviet leaders moved quickly to ease tensions with the United States, instructing China and North Korea to compromise on an armistice agreement. On March 15th, Georgi Malenkov publicly declared, "There is no disputed or unresolved question that cannot be settled peacefully." The new CIA director, Alan Dulles, reported that Soviet leaders seriously desired to lessen the dangers of global war. They even took preliminary steps toward liberalization within the Soviet Union. Churchill, who had been re-elected prime minister in 1951, had grown wary of the nuclear threat. He urged Washington to seize this unprecedented opportunity to end the Cold War conflict. He pressed for a summit with Soviet leaders. Eisenhower held his tongue for 6 weeks while his advisors crafted a response. He finally broke his silence, offering one of the most lucid statements ever made by a U.S. president on the toll the Cold War was taking on the nation. "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. In what seemed a dramatic departure, Eisenhower called for peace, disarmament, and third world development. But in equally fundamental ways, he remained an orthodox cold warrior, blaming the Soviets for the troubled state of the world. The New York Times called the speech magnificent and deeply moving. The Washington Post hoped that it signaled a rejection of Truman's provocative words, belligerent gesturings, militarization of policy, and aid to everybody who would turn anti-communist. Eisenhower, the Post felt, still needed to repudiate the theory that a crack of the whip from Moscow produces automatic obedience in the far corners of the satellite states and throughout Red China and communist-infected Asia. The Soviets reprinted the speech widely and offered some hopeful measures of their own, but the optimism proved short-lived. 2 days later, Dulles dismissed Malenkov's peace offensive as a peace defensive, taken in response to U.S. strength. He accused the communists of endlessly conspiring to overthrow from within every genuinely free government in the world. Perplexed, the Soviets wondered whether Eisenhower or Dulles spoke for the administration. They applauded Eisenhower for detailing the costs of U.S. militarism, but chided him for leaving out the astronomical cost of accumulating a vast nuclear arsenal and constructing hundreds of military bases around the world. Nor did the steps taken to end the fighting in Korea necessarily augur well for future relations. Despite making progress in the negotiations, Eisenhower threatened to widen the war and considered using tactical atomic weapons, which the United States first tested in January. At an NSC meeting in February, Eisenhaower identified the Kaesong area in North Korea as a good place to use the new weapon. In May, when Army Chief of Staff General J. Lawton Collins said that he was very skeptical about the value of using atomic weapons tactically in Korea, Eisenhower callously replied, "It might be cheaper dollar-wise to use atomic weapons in Korea than to continue to use conventional weapons." That month, the Joint Chiefs recommended and the NSC endorsed atomic attacks on China. Eisenhower and Dulles made sure the communist leaders knew of those threats. The United States also began bombing the dams near Pyongyang, causing enormous floods and destroying the rice crop. The Nuremberg Tribunal had condemned similar Nazi actions in Holland in 1944 as a war crime. Finally, in June, the two sides signed agreements settling the POW issue and agreeing on a truce demarcation line. But fighting intensified, and casualties skyrocketed on both sides. The morale of the UN forces plummeted. Desertions increased. Self-inflicted wounds reached epidemic proportions. On July 27, 1953, an armistice was finally signed by North Korea, China, and the United States, 2 years and 17 days after talks began. South Korea has still not signed. In August, Eisenhower kept up pressure, instructing LeMay to dispatch 20 nuclear-armed B-36 bombers to Kadena Air Base in Okinawa as part of Operation Big Stick. LeMay invited the press to observe their arrival. Eisenhower used atomic bombs repeatedly throughout his presidency in the same sense, as Daniel Ellsberg has argued, that a robber holding a gun to someone's head uses the gun without pulling the trigger. Among those who learned the lesson that nuclear threats could frighten an enemy into capitulating was Richard Nixon. In 1968, Nixon explained his strategy for dealing with North Vietnam to Bob Haldeman. "I call it the madman theory, Bob. I want the North Vietnamese to believe I've reached the point where I might do anything to stop the war. We'll just slip the word to them that, for God's sake, you know Nixon is obsessed about communists. We can't restrain him when he's angry, and he has his hand on the nuclear button. And Ho Chi Minh himself will be in Paris in 2 days begging for peace." Haldeman explained that Nixon saw a parallel in the action President Eisenhower had taken. When Eisenhower arrived in the White House, the Korean War was stalemated. He secretly got word to the Chinese that he would drop nuclear bombs. In a few weeks, the Chinese called for a truce and the Korean War ended. It worked, Nixon insisted. It was the bomb that did it. He credited Eisenhower with teaching him the value of unpredictability. If the adversary feels that you are unpredictable, even rash, he wrote, he will be deterred from pressing you too far. The odds that he will fold increase greatly, and the unpredictable president will win another hand. Eisenhower was certainly not a madman, but he paid little heed to how someone like Nixon might mimic his actions. The Korean War had its winners and its losers. Rees and Zhang's shaky regime survived. Japan profited. China had stood up to the Americans, enhancing its international prestige. But the Soviets had not, accelerating the Sino-Soviet split. And Churchill grasped the real meaning for the United States. Korea does not really matter now. I'd never heard of the bloody place until I was 74. Its importance lies in the fact that it has led to the rearming of America. Among the war's victims were the accused atomic spies Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Upon sentencing them to death in a highly controversial ruling, the judge charged, "Your conduct has already caused the communist aggression in Korea, with the resultant casualties exceeding 50,000 Americans." A casualty of a different sort was Henry Wallace. The Progressive Party's ranks had dwindled sharply after the 1948 election debacle, leaving it largely in the hands of communists, who, for the most part, remained uncritical of the Soviet Union. Wallace had seen enough of Stalinism to know how abhorrent it was. He told delegates to the Progressive Party convention in late February 1950, "The United States and Russia stand out today as the two big brutes of the world. Each in its own eyes rests on high moral principles, but each in the eyes of other nations is guided by force and force alone." The North Korean invasion of South Korea proved the final straw for Wallace. When Progressive Party leaders opposed UN action, he issued his own statement of conscience, insisting that the Soviets could have blocked the North Korean invasion in the first place if they'd wanted, and could stop it now. He declared, "I hold no brief for the past actions of either the United States or Russia, but when my country is at war and the United Nations sanctions that war, I am on the side of my country and the United Nations." But he urged U.S. leaders to break with recent policies, which he continued to deplore. "The United States will fight a losing battle in Asia as long as she stands behind feudal regimes based on exorbitant charges of landlords and money lords. Russia is using a mightier power than the atom bomb, as long as she helps the people get out from under their ancient aggressors. But we in the United States have a still mightier power, if we will only use it for the people." 3 weeks later, he resigned from the Progressive Party. After years of waging an often lonely, though courageous struggle against overwhelming odds, the indomitable visionary leader had finally had enough. Stalin's betrayals, when combined with the growing influence of domestic cold warriors, had sapped him of the strength needed to continue the fight. He retreated to his farm in upstate New York and spent his remaining years largely tending to his corn and chickens, which were then feeding much of the world. The final casualty of the war, some feared, was American manhood. One post-war study found that 70% of U.S. POWs had collapsed and collaborated with their captors. Some attributed the phenomenon to communist brainwashing. Others pointed to something more troubling. One army doctor who traveled about the camps to treat U.S. prisoners reported, "The strong regularly took food from the weak. Many men were sick, and these men, instead of being helped and nursed by the others, were ignored, or worse. On winter nights, helpless men with dysentery were rolled outside the huts by their comrades and left to die in the cold." An astounding 38% of U.S. prisoners died. Most withdrew into themselves and made little effort to find food or keep clean. The doctor attributed this to some new failure in the childhood and adolescent training of our young men, a new softness. If American men were getting soft, American technology would compensate. Just 3 days before Eisenhower's election, the United States tested its first prototype hydrogen bomb on the island of Ilulissat in the Eniwetok Atoll in the Marshall Islands. The island burned for 6 hours under a mushroom cloud 100 miles across, and then disappeared. The more than 10-megaton blast exceeded all expectations. A sailor commented, "You would swear the whole world was on fire." Physicist Harold Agnew was aboard a ship 25 miles away. He observed, "Something I'll never forget was the heat. Not the blast. The heat just kept coming on and on and on. And it was really scary." Eisenhower acknowledged the new reality in his inaugural address. "Science," he warned, "seems ready to confer upon us the power to erase human life from this planet." Yet his policies over the next 8 years propelled us ever more disastrously toward realizing that threat. It was as if Lewis Mumford's brilliant 1946 essay about the madness of American leaders had been written with the future Eisenhower in mind. As with his anti-communism, Eisenhower's embrace of nuclearism came later in life. He had opposed the atomic bombing of Japan on both military and moral grounds. He was actually in Moscow when he learned about Hiroshima. He told a journalist, "Before the atom bomb was used, I was sure we could keep the peace with Russia. Now I don't know. I had hoped the bomb wouldn't figure in this war. Until now I would have said that we three, Britain, America, and Russia, could have guaranteed the peace of the world for a long time to come. But now I don't know. People are frightened and disturbed all over. Everyone feels insecure again." After the war, he supported efforts at international control, wanting atomic bombs to be turned over to the United Nations and destroyed. He spoke out consistently for civilian rather than military control of the bomb. And he continued to raise moral concerns about the use of such a weapon. In 1947, he told a luncheon, "I decry loose and sometimes gloating talk about the degree of security implicit in a weapon that might destroy millions overnight." As David Rosenberg notes, Dwight D. Eisenhower entered the presidency in January 1953 with a more thorough knowledge of nuclear weapons than any president before or since. As Army Chief of Staff, temporary chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and NATO Supreme Commander, he had been intimately involved in earlier nuclear war planning. During those years, his abhorrence of nuclear weapons had abated considerably, but it had not disappeared. In March 1953, he warned his cabinet not to think of the bomb as a cheap way to solve things. He reminded them, "It is cold comfort for any citizen of Western Europe to be assured that, after his country is overrun and he is pushing up daisies, someone still alive will drop a bomb on the Kremlin." He was determined to build on the United States' lead in the nuclear arms race. In summer 1953, the CIA reported reassuringly that there was no evidence that the Soviets were working on a hydrogen bomb. On August 12, 1953, much to the CIA's chagrin, the Soviets exploded what was believed to have been a 400-kiloton hydrogen bomb in Kazakhstan. Though far less powerful than the U.S. model, the Soviet bomb was not only deliverable, it was dry, needing no refrigeration. The bulletin of the atomic scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight. It had stood at 3 since the Soviet atomic bomb test in 1949. The Soviets were closing the gap at a stunning pace. The New York Times took comfort in the fact that the United States still possessed a lead in atomic and hydrogen bomb production, but recognized that these advantages are bound to diminish with time. The Times noted that even Secretary of State Dulles had declared that the central problem now is to save the human race from extinction. Dulles and his relatives had helped design the American Empire. John Foster Dulles's maternal grandfather, John W. Foster, and his uncle, Robert Lansing, had both served as Secretary of State. John W. painstakingly tutored his eldest grandson throughout his childhood, instilling a firm belief in the United States' global role. John Foster Dulles's paternal grandfather and his father had both been Presbyterian ministers, his grandfather serving as a missionary in India. His younger brother, Alan, became director of the CIA. When his uncle Lansing served as Wilson's Secretary of State during and after the First World War, Dulles was Secretary-Treasurer of the government's new Russian Bureau, whose main function was to assist anti-Bolshevik forces challenging the Russian Revolution. Financier Bernard Baruch, an old family friend, next tapped the young lawyer to serve as legal advisor to the U.S. delegation to the Inter-Allied Reparations Commission at Versailles, after which he returned to practice law at Sullivan and Cromwell, overseeing the accounts of some of the pillars of the emerging empire, J.P. Morgan and Company, Brown Brothers Harriman, Dillon Reed, Goldman Sachs, United Fruit Company, International Nickel Company, United Railways of Central America, and the Overseas Securities Corporation. Though journalistic accounts of Dulles's unabashed affection for Hitler in the early years of the Nazi dictatorship are hard to verify, there is no doubt that he maintained some involvement in German business activities. He participated actively in the vast interwar cartelization, which afforded a means to stabilize the shaky U.S. economy, reduce competition, and guarantee profits. Dulles dealt extensively with I.G. Farben through the nickel and chemical cartels. Despite his later vehement denials of any dealings with the Nazi regime, he is known to have visited Berlin in 1934, 1935, 1936, 1937, and 1939. In assessing Dulles's involvement, award-winning New York Times and Boston Globe foreign correspondent Stephen Kinzer, citing Nancy Lissagor and Frank Lipsius's exhaustive study of Sullivan and Cromwell, writes that the firm thrived on its cartels and collusion with the new Nazi regime, and Dulles spent much of 1934 publicly supporting Hitler, leaving his partners shocked that he could so easily disregard law and international treaties to justify Nazi repression. Dulles never wavered in his commitment to maintaining U.S. hegemony and protecting U.S. business interests or in his hatred of communism. Despite outward appearances, the rigid, sometimes belligerent Secretary of State and the affable President differed little on substantive policy issues. Eisenhower understood that even with income tax rates topping 90% for the wealthiest Americans, the nation's bloated military budget would prove impossible to sustain, ultimately bankrupting the country. He worried, this country can choke itself to death piling up military expenditures. He decided to curb ballooning defense spending by relying on nuclear arms, which were cheaper than maintaining a large standing army. In late October 1953, he approved a new basic national security policy, NSC 162/2, the core of his new-look defense policy, which stated, in the event of hostilities, the United States will consider nuclear weapons to be as available for use as other munitions. Based on the assumption that any war with the Soviet Union would quickly evolve into a full-scale nuclear war, the new look downplayed conventional military capabilities and relied upon massive nuclear retaliation by the Fortified Strategic Air Command. Thus, the savings made by reducing the size of the army were offset, in large part, by increased spending on the Air Force and Navy. Eisenhower ended up cutting Truman's 1954 defense budget from $41.3 billion to $36 billion. Eisenhower felt constrained by the fact that neither the U.S. public nor his British allies were as sanguine as he and Dulles about the use of nuclear weapons. He set out to erase the line between conventional and nuclear weapons. According to the minutes of a late March 1953 NSC discussion of using nuclear weapons in Korea, the President and Secretary Dulles were in complete agreement that somehow or other the taboo which surrounds the use of atomic weapons would have to be destroyed. Dulles called for breaking down this false distinction between conventional and nuclear weapons, which he attributed to a Soviet propaganda campaign. Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Arthur Radford explained to listeners at the Naval War College in May 1954 that atomic forces are now our primary forces. Actions by forces on land, sea, or air are relegated to a secondary role. Nuclear weapons, fission, and fusion will be used in the next major war. In meetings in Bermuda with Britain's Churchill and French Premier Joseph Laniel in December 1953, Eisenhower sought his allies' support for using atomic bombs if fighting started in Korea again. Churchill sent his private secretary, Jock Colville, to Eisenhower to express his concerns. Colville was taken aback by Eisenhower's response, whereas Winston looked on the atomic bomb as something entirely new and terrible. He looked upon it as just the latest improvement in military weapons. He implied that there was no distinction between conventional weapons and atomic weapons. All weapons in due course become conventional. Colville later wrote, "I could hardly believe my ears." Eisenhower similarly told Anthony Eden, "The development of smaller atomic weapons and the use of atomic artillery makes the distinction between atomic and conventional weapons impossible to sustain." In 1955, Eisenhower responded to a reporter's question about using tactical atomic weapons. "Yes, of course they would be used. In any combat where these things can be used on strictly military targets and for strictly military purposes, I see no reason why they shouldn't be used, just exactly as you would use a bullet or anything else." The very next day, Nixon reinforced the point. "Tactical atomic explosives are now conventional and will be used against the targets of any aggressive force." A few weeks later, Ike told Congress that a wide variety of tactical atomic weapons have today achieved conventional status in the arsenals of our armed forces. Eisenhower prepared for their use by transferring control of the atomic stockpile from the AEC to the military. Truman had transferred 9 weapons to Guam in 1951, but had otherwise insisted on retaining civilian control. He said he did not want to have some dashing lieutenant colonel decide when would be the proper time to drop one. Eisenhower had no such compunctions. In June 1953, he began transferring atomic bombs from the AEC to the Defense Department to enhance operational readiness and protect them from surprise Soviet attack. In December 1954, he ordered 42% of atomic bombs and 36% of hydrogen bombs deployed overseas, many menacingly close to the Soviet Union. By 1959, the military had custody of more than 80% of U.S. nuclear weapons. The United States' European allies were terrified that the United States would start a nuclear war, and they pressured Eisenhower to lower the tensions. He responded on December 8, 1953, mesmerizing the 3,500 delegates at the United Nations with his Atoms for Peace speech, declaring that the United States would devote its entire heart and mind to find the way by which the miraculous inventiveness of man shall not be dedicated to his death, but consecrated to his life, by spreading the benefits of peaceful atomic power at home and abroad. The U.S. media rang out with praise. New York Times military correspondent Hanson Baldwin wrote that Eisenhower's eloquent and moving argument for peace represented an earnest attempt to halt the atomic arms race. However, Baldwin regretted that the prospects for success remained bleak because the Soviet Union's whole concept is built upon world struggle and ultimate world domination. Eisenhower was so desperate to put a smiling face on the atom that he ignored numerous warnings about the danger of proliferation. The AEC's only nuclear physicist, Henry Smith, dismissed Adams for Peace as a thoroughly dishonest proposal that ignored proliferation risks and exaggerated the prospects of nuclear power. Others echoed his dissent. Soviet leaders were particularly irked by the dangers of proliferation. Five top scientists, including nuclear physicist Igor Kurchatov, asserted that the development of the industrial use of atomic energy by itself does not only not exclude, but leads directly to an increase of military atomic potential. Foreign Minister Molotov reiterated this point in meetings with Dulles, and in a note stating that it was possible for the very application of atomic energy for peaceful purposes to be utilized for increasing the production of atomic weapons. When Molotov again raised the proliferation risk at their May 1st meeting, Dulles couldn't grasp the concept and replied that he would seek out a scientist to educate him more fully. If Eisenhower's UN address raised hopes for an easing of international tensions, Dulles's January 12th speech to the Council on Foreign Relations dashed them thoroughly. He warned that local defenses against communism would be backed by massive retaliatory power, deployed at places and with means of our own choosing. Reliance on nuclear weapons represented a fundamental departure from previous policy. Whereas Truman, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, had viewed atomic bombs as weapons that would be used only in the most desperate circumstances, Eisenhower made them the foundation of U.S. defense strategy. The Wall Street Journal reported, "There was a wide assumption that here was a reckless policy of turning every minor clash into an atomic Armageddon." The New York Times' James Reston was stunned that Eisenhower and Dulles were enacting a new strategy, potentially graver than anything ever proposed by any United States government, and not a single congressman even questioned this commitment to sudden atomic retaliation. He worried about the constitutional implications of such expanded presidential powers. If the Chinese moved into Indochina, or the Soviets into Iran, who, he asked, would give the order to deploy massive retaliatory power against Beijing or Moscow? How, he wondered, could the president seek the consent of the Congress without alerting the Kremlin and risking a sudden atomic blow upon the United States? RAND analyst Joseph Loftus became concerned that the new SAC emergency war plan was targeting Soviet cities and civilian populations. While Loftus was visiting SAC headquarters in Omaha, General James Walsh, the director of SAC intelligence, invited him over to his house for cocktails and began lecturing him on the need to maximize destruction. Walsh suddenly exploded. "God damn it, Loftus. There's only one way to attack the Russians, and that's to hit them hard with everything we have and," he shouted, pounding his fist on the enormous Bible on the table, "knock their balls off." By the spring of 1954, SAC's war plan called for attacking the Soviet Union with 600 to 750 bombs and turning it into a smoking, radiating ruin at the end of 2 hours. The plan involved killing 80% of the population in 118 major cities, or 60 million people. Later that year, the United States began deploying nuclear weapons on the soil of its European allies. By 1958, almost 3,000 had been placed in Western Europe. Meanwhile, the U.S. arsenal continued to grow at a dizzying pace, expanding from slightly over 1,000 when Eisenhower took office to over 22,000 bombs when he left office 8 years later. Massive retaliation might frighten the Soviets, but it would do little to thwart the revolutionary upsurge in the developing world, where the Soviet Union was poised to take advantage of widespread discontent. The most important Third World leaders, Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, Josip Broz Tito of Yugoslavia, and Jawaharlal Nehru of India, steered a neutral course between the capitalist and socialist blocs and thought it obscene to spend billions of dollars and rubles on arms when money for economic development was in short supply. On his first trip abroad in May 1953, Dulles learned of hostility toward the United States in Asia, where the Soviet system had real appeal, and in the Middle East. During his trip, he wrote to Eisenhower about bitterness in the Arab world, where the United States suffered from being linked with British and French imperialism, and from its blind support for Israel. Dulles wasn't sure that the United States could ever win the allegiance of third world peoples. He noted that asking underdeveloped countries to embrace capitalism was like asking people who were undernourished and suffering from rickets to play rugby. You say to them, "Have a free competitive system," and they say, "Good God, there must be a better way of doing things." Eisenhower was also troubled by the depth of animosity toward the United States among the world's impoverished masses. He raised the issue at a March 1953 NSC meeting, wondering why it wasn't possible to get some of the people in these downtrodden countries to like us instead of hating us. The United States' role in the Iranian conflict should have provided all the answer Eisenhower needed. Upon taking office, Eisenhower confronted a crisis in Iran. –